The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutam dhammam sangham namassami. So I just took refuge in the Buddha and his teachings and the community of the Buddha's followers, the awakened ones. So I was invited to speak on renunciation. Mark had invited me to speak about renunciation this evening when I came, before I came actually. But anyway, so and I thought of the title for the talk to be the blessing of renunciation, and that renunciation isn't just for those in robes, for monastics, but there's aspects of renunciation that people can embrace, they can incorporate in their lives to help support their practice, the Buddhist practice. So I started doing some research before coming here, and I looked up what the English definition of renunciation was. It says, the formal rejection of something, typically a belief, claim, or course of action. And then synonyms, abstinence from, refraining from, going without, doing without, giving up. I'm not sure what askew all this. Rejection of, repudiation, rejection, abandonment, forsaking, forswearing, disavowal, denial. So you might be asking yourself, how can this be a blessing? So it sounds like going without, doing without, denying ourselves things that we might be enjoying, depriving ourselves. But then there's this idea for doing that for a higher aim. So the Buddha, really, he was teaching the middle way, so he wasn't advocating any kind of self-torment. I think the idea of giving up something for a higher aim is something we might consider. And in our society, we're aware of people doing things like giving up alcohol. And they may have gotten into a lot of trouble in their lives because of drinking. So then they have to abstain from doing that. So they see the harm in that. They see the harm in the overuse of something. You may, something like alcohol, you have to completely give up if you're an alcoholic. I worked in alcohol and drug treatment. There's no middle way and there's no moderation with it if you have the disease of alcoholism. So the Buddha wasn't talking about completely giving up any kind of pleasures of the senses, but he was asking for, he talked about the middle way, and you might look at a monastic and think, well, how can that really be the middle way? They've renounced dinner. They don't eat dinner. They've renounced their hair. They've renounced any style and clothing. So they just have to wear the same thing day after day. But for the monastic, it's just really simplifying our lives. I don't have really, when I wake up in the morning, I really don't have to think about what I'm going to wear. I mean, I have a tiny bit of choice. I mean, I should put on what's clean. So it's a way of simplifying our lives and directing our lives to the focus of practice, focusing on practice. But for lay people, we can do for periods of time different forms of renunciation. We may decide, I mean, when I first started meditating, I was smoking pot and drinking, and I realized that it didn't mix with meditation very well. The instructions I was given for meditation, my mind was on any of those substances, that, you know, it just didn't work very well. So I didn't, and then I heard there was this teaching of the three pure precepts, and that's avoiding all evil, doing good, and purifying the mind. So I thought, purifying the mind. I don't think I'm doing that if I'm drinking. So this was a natural giving up of this, because I could see the harm that it was causing my mind. And some people may see the harm that certain things are causing their relationship. So naturally, we start, when we're really observing our lives, really observing the impact of our behavior, we'll start seeing certain things that we do need to give up, we do need to let go of. So it can be a very natural process. The more sensitive we become through our meditation, through studying the Buddhist teaching, we might, you know, just explore how it is to do without some things that we think that we really need. And for instance, all of you came here, I don't know what you might ordinarily be doing on a Tuesday evening, but you've given up doing that to come here. And to meditate, a lot of times you have to carve out a certain amount of time in your lives. You know, you have to juggle your life a little bit. Maybe you're letting go, you know, like letting go of eating out or going to a movie or something like that. So it's can be a natural process. But you can see, you know, the Buddha talks a lot about cause and effect. And you say, okay, what is it like when I sit quietly instead of stimulating myself looking at social media or whatever it is that I'm giving up for a period of time in order to sit quietly? So this is a kind of a natural way that you might start to explore the idea of renunciation. The actual term that's translated as renunciation is nekama. That's the Pali for it's translated as renunciation, and it's often described as a blessing, as something actually pleasurable. So you might be wondering, how can that be? Again, and if you think about it, if you come and you sit on the cushion, when you're meditating, you're letting go of a lot mentally. And one of the things the Buddha encouraged people to let go of is sensual desire. And this is what actually nekama is pointed to, is the abandoning or renouncing of sensual desire. So this is, it can be just for while you're sitting on the cushion. So if you're sitting on the cushion, free from any kind of desire, you would be content. You would be, a sense of pleasure would come up. If you're sitting on the cushion and you're thinking, gotta go here, gotta do this, I need to get that, wouldn't it be good to eat this? The mind is like really agitated, going here and there, trying, grasping after things. Or the other side of it would be just reminiscing about the past and, oh, how wonderful it was, and craving for something from the past. So the mind is very unsettled then. So letting go of desire. This is actually really basic to the Buddhist teaching. I think most of you are familiar with the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth is the truth of suffering, that you know, there is suffering. Suffering exists. And then the second is the cause. And the cause of suffering is craving. So there we have desire, usually often at the senses. Craving is, if you, a meditator can start really looking at the experience of desire or craving and seeing the discomfort. The craving itself is suffering. And craving can cause a lot of suffering in the world, especially if we act on it. So renunciation starts with the mind. You may make a determination to let go of some behaviors, or you may look at how possible it is to let go of craving. Can I let go of desire? Can I really settle my mind? Can I really be in the present moment? So if I can just stay with the breath, but I'm not going to crave that either. I'm not going to crave the stability of the mind. Maybe at some points in my meditation, or you know, on retreat, I've had really blissful states. So I'm not going to crave that either. But we might make a determination. Okay, what, you know, maybe this you know, I can let go whenever I see craving arise. I'll just recognize it and I'll just let it go. Actually, this is what the Buddha did shortly before his awakening. I have a printout of a sutta. This is from the Middle Length Discourses, and it's called Two Kinds of Thought. It's Majjhima Nikaya 19, or number 19 in the Middle Length Discourses. And this was just shortly before his awakening, and he was just observing what was going on in his mind. He was seeing thoughts arising. And then, so I'll read some from it. It says, Bhikkhus, well, that means monks. Before my enlightenment, while I was still an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set one on one side, thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And on the other side, thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of non-cruelty. So before his awakening, he was still having these thoughts of desire, of cruelty, but he of ill will, but he also was having thoughts of renunciation, non-ill will, which sometimes can be described as loving kindness, and non-cruelty can be called compassion, karuna. So he was just observing his thoughts, and he was just, okay, he decided to divide them into wholesome and unwholesome states of mind or thoughts. And then as I abided diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire rose in me. And I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. So he was identifying the thoughts, and then he was also seeing how they affected him. So this is very effective. If we see, I mean, when I, if I feel anger arising, I angry thought comes up, and I really see how it's affecting me, see how it's affecting my body. And then I also realize if I'm really angry and I speak, I might say something that might be harmful to somebody else. So this is what he was doing. He was really examining cause and effect. He was really examining, these thoughts are very powerful. So so this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. It obstructs wisdom, leads away from Nibbana. When he considered that, he was able to abandon those thoughts, those unwholesome thoughts. So the same with the thought of ill will and the thought of cruelty. Whenever they arose, he really pondered, this is harmful. If I acted on this, this is going to cause harm to myself or harm to others. And just thinking at it, you know, like I think there's studies to show the biochemistry in the body when somebody gets really angry or really irritated. And it's harmful to us. It's, you know. So he abandoned these thoughts and did away with them. He says, you say, bhikkhus or monks or, and you could, he's talking to all of us. Whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become their inclination of the mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And that's the same with thoughts of cruelty and thoughts of ill will. So if we, you know, like perpetuate these thoughts in our mind, we're cultivating them, and we're not allowing, if we're cultivating ill will, we're not allowing loving kindness to arise. So, but we're speaking about renunciation here. So if we're like full of desire, we're not able to cultivate thoughts of renunciation. So, so whatever someone thinks and ponders about, then that's the inclination of their mind. So he saw in the unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in the wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So I, when I first read that, I just thought that was just so beautiful. In the wholesome states, the blessing of renunciation and the aspects of cleansing. So we're helping our cleanse our mind, purifying our mind by relinquishing or abandoning or renouncing unwholesome mental states. So this is where renunciation starts with the mind. We start by purifying our mind by abandoning thoughts that are harmful. And so that allows the thoughts of kindness, the thoughts of renunciation to arise. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids in wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. If someone frequently and thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, they have abandoned the thoughts of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, and then their mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. So then, this sutta continues where he, even the wholesome thoughts, even the wholesome thoughts could be somewhat disturbing to the mind because the mind isn't entirely still and at peace. So at a certain point, he saw that it could be tiring if he's always bringing up these kind of thoughts. But then he actually entered into absorption. He just abandoned any kind of thought process. And he went, this actually is right before his awakening. And he entered the jhanas, or the absorptions. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered and abided in the first jhana, and all the other jhanas, and all the higher attainments until he reached Nibbana. He had the three knowledges. Anyway, I won't get into this, but you can read this sutta. It's in, you can find it online, Access to Insight, or actually Sutta Central. And so what's really striking here too is it's quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. So first he had to purify his mind, and then he had to still his mind completely. You know, he just really stilled the active thought processes in order to enter into the jhanas and to really see, to have the true knowledge. So this is how the three knowledges actually. So this is how the Buddha attained awakening, is by really observing his mind. And at a mental level, he was living a life of extreme asceticism, so he didn't have to worry about renunciation on the physical plane, but he still had to work on his mind. I have something here by that was written by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and I have to make sure I have the whole, and I'd like to read that. I think I have time. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a translator. He's a scholar monk, but he's very, has deep understanding of the Dhamma from all of his exploring of translating the suttas. So he's very eloquent, actually, if you've ever heard him speak. But this is something he wrote. It's called Renunciation's Benefit. Contemplating the dukkha, well, dukkha is often translated as suffering or stress or distress, inherent in desire, is one way to incline the mind to renunciation. Another way is to contemplate directly the benefits flowing from a renunciation. To move from desire to renunciation is not, as it might be imagined, to move from happiness to grief, from abundance to destitution. It is to pass from gross, entangling pleasures to an exalted happiness and peace, from a condition of servitude to one's self-mastery. Desire ultimately breeds fear and sorrow, but renunciation gives fearlessness and joy. It promotes the accomplishment of all three stages of the threefold training. It purifies conduct, aids concentration, and nourishes the seed of wisdom. So that's the threefold training. Conduct or morality, concentration, and wisdom. The entire course of practice from start to finish can in fact be seen as a stage of relinquishment, the relinquishing of all foundations of existence. So that's Nibbana. Completely letting go. Complete freedom, because we're not tied to anything. So we're talking about renunciation in terms of mental formations, in terms of at a level of the mind. But we can, as Bhikkhu Bodhi was talking about, there's a threefold training. So conduct or morality. And what is that? That's somebody's. I thought that was some alarm. I'm supposed to do something. No. Okay. So the first part of the of conduct is sila in Pali, which some people are familiar with the precepts. So for lay people, there's five precepts. And we can also take eight precepts. So the five precepts are aimed at harmlessness, non-harming. Is everyone familiar with the five precepts? Pretty much so. So you can see that if you really are following the five precepts, maybe it becomes natural to you, and it's the natural behavior of someone who's entered the stream. They wouldn't break any of the five precepts. But I'll read, I have the eight precepts in front of me, and I'll read these through, and this is are called renunciant precepts. So the five precepts is refraining from destroying any living creature, refraining from taking what is not given, and that's translated as not stealing. And then refraining from any sexual misconduct. And then refraining from harmful speech, false harmful speech, and refraining from intoxicating drinks and drugs, which lead to carelessness. So these may be pretty simple or easy for many people to follow, but you're actually refraining, you may be refraining from some activities that you've previously did if you want to keep these precepts, particularly some of them. Like for some people, even like not killing an ant, that's a change in behavior. If you start keeping this precept seriously, when it becomes a renunciant precept, then any kind of sexual activity that instead of refraining from any kind of harmful, let's say there's, where do they have it here? I undertake the precept, oh, this is the eight. So refraining from, there's another, now I can't remember it right now. Any kind of harmful activity, any kind of, there's another, it's sexual misconduct, is that's how they usually say it. So anything that may be harmful to others or to oneself. But then this precept changes to celibacy for it to be a renunciant precept. And then the other three is to refrain from eating after noon, and refraining from singing, dancing, playing music, going to shows, wearing beautification. And then the last one is to refrain from higher luxurious sleeping places. So those precepts some people may keep during retreat time or for, you know, like a, you may keep it for a lunar observance day, like the full moon or the new moon. They're at temples. I think a lot of people will go to the temple and they'll wear white and they'll take the eight precepts and they'll keep it for a day. But you can keep it for any period of time. So this is just kind of getting your feet wet a little bit with renunciation you can keep these precepts for short periods of time. Or some people decide to keep them for their lives. And some people, this is the, for our community, these eight precepts are taken to be a resident, to be the first stage of in the monastic life, to become an anagarika. People take these eight precepts, or people can go to a monastery and stay for a few weeks and keep these precepts in a monastic setting. So that's as far as a body, that's a physical activity, or speech. Musawada is the precept around speech, and that's very important for everyone to refrain from harmful speech, from false speech, from malicious speech, from harsh speech. These precepts are designed to help support our practice. So this is part of the threefold training. And these aid in concentration. And as we were seeing from the sutta I was reading from, if we have angry or harmful thoughts, we may act on them. So if we are aware of them in our meditation or daily activity, and as soon as we can, we abandon them, we're less likely to be breaking these precepts. So it works both ways. If we're breaking precepts, then we have cause for remorse, or our mind is agitated, and it's harder to gain concentration. And also, he was saying it's obstruction to wisdom. So if the mind is scattered and the mind is confused and going in different directions, it's really hard for us to gain wisdom. So this is how those eight precepts fit in with this idea of renunciation. So there's like different possibilities for people, but it starts with the mind. We start with really making a determination to abandon harmful thoughts, abandon obsession with sense desires. We may decide we want to simplify our lives, or deciding to come for meditation, and we're setting aside something we usually used to do in the evening. So I offer this for your reflection, and open it up for questions, comments. And then I'm supposed to remind people, are you turning off the recorder?
No, I'm
Oh, okay. So I'm supposed to, there's little signs here that says, remind folks that the question and answer period is being recorded. So if you're afraid that somebody's going to have voice recognition and know it's you asking this question, and you don't want, I don't know how far and wide this is going to be spread, but anyway, just to be aware of. So now the mic is on, and if anyone would like to ask a question.
My name is Alan. I'm just wondering how what would be called a householder would see renunciation perhaps different than a monastic person, or if there is a difference in the view of that.
Well, monastics have the advantage of being in a community and everybody's doing the same thing. Everybody's not eating after a certain time. Everybody's keeping particular, at least the 8 precepts. So we're kind of have an understanding of one another, and we know what we're doing. Before I went into robes or joined a monastic community, I decided to keep the 8 precepts. And the one that's really tricky is not eating after solar noon. And there are some things that we can have. There's tea and other things that are allowed. In this culture, we have cheese and chocolate, so it's kind of funny. But we really we don't have a regular meal. So I wasn't eating. I was still working, and I wasn't eating after a certain time. And I was very serious about all 8 precepts. I was celibate. And the one around the eating is difficult to keep and for other people to understand why you would even want to do that. But for lay people, I think you can take precepts for a period of time, or you can, like I was saying, observing the mind. This is a renunciation on the level of the mind, and really observing how we're driven by our craving. This is actually the true meaning of nikkhama, or what's translated as renunciation, is abandoning sensual desire. So we start looking at it really carefully in ourselves. We're seeing how we're driven by it, how it's impacting us, and we start letting go of it more and more. There's a one of the suttas, there's a expression about life. Life is insatiable, a slave to craving, this craving slave. So like this insatiability, we can see that in ourselves. We can see the suffering in that. And then, so it doesn't mean that we have to really deprive ourselves, but can we practice moderation? I think moderation is one of the more difficult things to practice. When I was working in alcohol and drug treatment, abstinence, complete abstinence, is relatively straightforward. But we had a program for eating disorder. And for people to learn moderation in eating, you have to eat. People are going to extremes. They're starving themselves, or they're binge eating, they're overeating. How do I find the middle way? How do I eat just enough? You know, this is a thing too with even if we don't eat after a certain time, most solid foods we don't eat after a certain time. A lot of times there's a lot of food that's put out, you know, for us. People bring lots of food to the monastery, all kinds of foods, desserts, and all this kind of stuff, and you can still overeat. So just to say, okay, how do I take just enough? This is a form of renunciation. So that the food's a simple thing. And I know that some people have become celibate. Lay people have become celibate. And if you're not, it's not so difficult if you're not already in a relationship. But I've known married couples that they both decided their dedication to their practice. They decided to become celibate. So, but that's, it really needs to be your choice. And but you might look at just how. Well, I know one person was having difficulty physically, and she had to abstain from sex, and her husband said, "There's more to our relationship than just sex." This are more to a marriage than just sex. So so we can look at things like that, and maybe periodically, well, during retreat time, of course, you know, this may be a time that kind of sensuality is put by the wayside. So there's periods of time that you can take some of these more renunciant precepts. But it is really more at the mind. And just look at if what I'm doing, is it harmful? Is it harming anyone else? This is another thing to look at. We really should abandon activities that are harmful. So with the first precept, if you are in the habit of when you're cleaning up your house, if there's ants, you just clean them up too. You know, like you might kill the ants. But if you are a meditator and you start really looking closely at these little tiny beings, you can see they have fear. They really cherish their lives. So we learn how to take care not to harm, refrain from harming other beings by developing sensitivity. So this is one way that renunciation will start coming naturally rather than kind of imposing it on yourself. I wouldn't impose celibacy on a happy relationship or something like that. But there may be times when you're just apart for retreat times or something like that. Something that's, naturally, easefully, if you're, that doesn't cause harm to the other person as much as possible. That gets kind of sticky, though, because what people want and what's actually harmful, you know, it might get kind of confused. So but I think the key thing is to look at non-harming first. Another thing I forgot to mention is that on the Noble Eightfold Path, the first is right view, and the second is right intention. And renunciation, non-ill will, and non-harming, this is right intention. So that we're keeping our intention, right intention, with right understanding, a right view of what we're doing. And this will help guide us in renunciation. So they're all mutually supportive. So I hope that, I don't know if that's helpful. But it's for our own exploration, I think. And then when we do have periods of time when we let go of some behaviors that we are used to doing, we can just see how it's impacting us, how it's the impact on our meditation or our mental state.
Hello, my name is Ning, and I want to ask you about five percept. It's a five percept, but it's a number three. Percept number three is like, it was stuck in my mind, like, what is the Buddha course on the baking rule on this one, on number three? It's, you know, because the people start have like relationship feelings, you know, felt together, or kissing, hugging, you know, it start picking up the rule, or it's still like,
For if you have five precepts, that precept that is kame sumi chachara, you're familiar with that. That's abstaining from sexual misconduct. Misconduct in that you would be doing sexual behavior that's harmful to others. So Thich Nhat Hanh described it as respecting your own and others' relationships. So you wouldn't be involving yourself in a relationship that was harming. So you would respect other people's relationships and you'd respect your own relationship. So the physical activity between a couple, that's not breaking that precept.
Until you go to bed and you breaking the rule.
Unless you're forcing yourself on your spouse or something like that.
And then you break the rule.
But if it's a consensual relationship and it's not, I don't know, in this society, we should respect other people's relationships and not do anything that would harm others' relationships too. So.
Because in my mind, like, you know, because it's American culture, like hugging, kissing, you know, it's a normal thing.
Oh, touching.
Yeah, touching, hugging is a normal thing for, you know, for the people, you know. It's not like Asian people. Asian people, like the guy and the lady touching, you break the rule, you get fined for that. They fight for you for chicken, they fight you for the pig. That's why I asked. And okay, that is depend on the culture.
Yeah, I think what's acceptable in, you know, your social system too. There's that. I think, you know, innocent kind of touching when or affectionate, I mean, that's fine. But monastics should be more restrained, although some some do hug, but I think something innocent like that is okay. That's fine.
Oh, okay.
The main thing, like I was saying, is this causing harm to myself or others?
Thank you for being here tonight. I'm interested to know, this tradition is also represented by art forms that are very precise, like the Tibetan paintings with a hair, the Zen rock gardens that are perfect, and architecture that is, the craftsmanship is extraordinary and in some cases opulent. That seems a little contradictory to the renunciation. Why is that?
There's degrees, and there's like, this is an artistic expression coming from somebody's heart, something to inspire people. So it's not really, I think there's like, appreciation of beauty or appreciation of art form, and you know, like this is maybe it's pleasurable or brings joy or happiness, but it's not the kind of sensuality that's harmful. So like I was saying again, this is one of the key things to see. Is it causing harm for myself or others? I mean, it can be a distraction. I mean, if you really want to get into deep meditation and really want to understand the Buddhist teaching and you're spending all your time doing artwork, you might be just kind of avoiding the issue. You're not looking at your own mind. You're not working on your own, you know, like any defilements or unwholesome mental states. You're just, you know, or you're just going to the museum. And so it's like, it can be an inspiration for somebody. Some people can look at the image of the Buddha and be very inspired and want to start meditating. Because, oh, this Buddha image is so peaceful looking. It's really evoking this really peaceful feeling in me. And so I want to find out about this. What did the Buddha say? And how do I get, how can I be like that? How could I? So you know, it isn't really limited or you know, kind of the idea of renunciation just being kind of depriving yourself or not having any kind of artistic expression. I'm going to Arrow River, and I wrote because there's one novice there is going to receive higher ordination sometime this summer. So I said, well, what can I bring him? And I got, some art supplies would be good, some pencils, some art, you know, some nice colored pencils for sketching, you know. So it's not like we're denied that kind of artistic expression. I know in the Zen tradition, raking the yard and doing things very mindfully, very purposely, very carefully, this is a form of meditation. So it's not seen as sensual in that kind of respect, where it's disruptive of your, you know, progress on the path. It actually can be helpful. For some people, it can be helpful. So is that okay? Oh, the Tibetan tradition too, that's a whole meditation to do those tankas. They're really precise. They use them, I think they use them for visualization, and they're very detailed, and this is one way of working with the mind, and there's a lot of deep symbolism in those tankas. There's a lot of aspects of the teachings that are represented in them. So it's one way of, this is, as far as I know, as far as I understand, this is a way that they're doing their a particular practice.
Before you became the bhikkhuni, you were selected with the alcohol, right? And you went to the hospital at all on that time?
Pardon me?
Before you became the bhikkhuni, you are detected with the alcohol, alcoholics. You detect with the alcohol. Before you became the bhikkhuni.
I worked in alcohol and drug treatment.
Yeah.
I was a nurse. I was working in a chemical dependency ward or unit, in the hospital. So what is your question?
I said, have you never been to the hospital for that?
Have I been to the hospital for that?
Yeah.
No.
No,
I wasn't an alcoholic, but I saw the damage that alcohol and people in my lives, my lives, yeah, how harmful it was. And so it was just coincidental that I ended up in, because that was, when I first started looking for work, that was what I saw in the paper, and I got hired right away. But there's a lot of parallels with in giving up something that's so harmful. You know, like the people have to go through a lot of self-searching and really examine themselves and really being honest with themselves. And this is some of what we do in meditation, which is really this kind of this expression they called a fearless moral inventory of oneself one was supposed to take. And so this is kind of what we do when we're sitting on the cushion. We have to really look at ourselves honestly. It's right there in that sutta. The Buddha was just looking and he was seeing thoughts of cruelty, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of sensual desire. And he'd spent 7 years in a very deep asceticism, and this was still coming up. So we really have to be honest with ourselves and really say, oh, this behavior is harmful. I need to let go of it. I'm harming myself, or I'm harming others, or I'm harming both myself and others. Oh, this is something I really need to let go of. So this is one of the beautiful things about that kind of treatment program. If people can really be successful, they're really working on themselves. They're really deeply looking at themselves. So this is potentially what we can be doing when we're sitting on the cushion.
Them long to be healed? A 5 year, 4 year, 3 year to be healed, yeah. Take that time to be healed, like to be healed from the alcohol, like 3 year, 4 year, or 1 year. Yeah, how long?
Oh, it's a whole lifetime process. You can't stop going to meetings or can't stop working with oneself or
drinking.
Yeah, or you go back to drinking. So it depends on how long somebody's been drinking.
Okay.
But as far as healing, as far as on the physical level, you know, depending on how much damage you've done from drinking.
I see.
Yeah, it varies because people can damage their liver. But the good news is that the brain actually heals over time from abstaining from liquor. They've done studies, and the brain damage from drinking, well, unless there's severe liver damage and it's gotten really toxic, but there is a certain amount of healing that goes along with that even. So I think Mark had a...
Thanks, Aya. I thought it might be nice, I'd like to hear, and maybe others, because they may not know much about the monastic lifestyle and just generally your schedule and how you live in community and how that's a renunciation, living with others and coming into some kind of agreement and how you're going to live and, you know, run the monastery together. Yeah, but just maybe paint a picture of what your life is like. You've done that a little bit, but it might be nice for me and others just to hear
how you live together in that renunciate lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Well, our schedule actually starts at, well, we don't have a formal meditation in the morning, but we have, because people sit for different lengths of time, but we have morning chanting at 6. So we're expecting that people will be meditating for, some people will go into the meditation hall at different times and start meditating, and some will meditate on their own in their rooms. But there's morning chanting at 6, and then we have breakfast at 7, and then some people either be from about 6:30 to 7, some people will be preparing breakfast, and then there might be some light chores that people are doing. And then we have breakfast, and we have a morning meeting. We usually we have a little bit of Dhamma reflection to start with, and then we talk about practical things. And then we have a work period where some people are preparing the meal, and there's other things that we may be doing, you know, other projects or cleaning or whatever work needs to be done. And then we have a meal at 11. And then after that, after the meal cleanup, then some people have more work that they're doing, and some people finish up. I usually try to finish up what I'm doing and have some hours in before the evening program for meditation. I usually try to, well, it varies depending on what's going on. So that's just kind of a sketch. And then 7 p.m. we have evening chanting, and then we have meditation then, group meditation. And that's, we call it no bell silence, because we don't ring the bell. People can sit as long. This is Bhajan Brahm has coined this phrase, no bell silence, because he thinks that people should be able to meditate as long as they're comfortable. So that's what we do, because some people can sit for an hour and a half and other people can't. So we have one day on Sundays, we have programs. We have, the monastery in Santa Rosa, we have people coming. There's a morning meditation from 9:30 till about 10:40. We have a beginner's instruction and for about a half an hour, and then people can either come after that or stay until 10:40. And then we have the meal. And then at 1 o'clock, we have a sutta discussion. And there is, oops. So that. I usually get up at 4 if I can. I don't always succeed, but. I go to bed. I try to stay up till, if I stay up till 10, I think I'm doing good. But sometimes I go to bed a little earlier than that. Depending on my health, I've been having sciatica. So sometimes it's difficult because I have to, if I'm in too much pain, I have to rest more. So, and then we have a winter time, we started having retreat periods. last winter we had 2 months of retreat, and so we try to we have outside teachings that some of us do, so we stop the outside teachings and we spend our time just the very minimum practical things to keep things running. And then some of us are on seclusion and some of us are keeping things operating. And then we switch. Like I'll have a month that I'm managing the retreat, but we have a lot more time because we're not engaging in a lot of outside activities. But we do keep the doors open for people to come and join us in meditation. And we keep the teaching going, but we have some kind of theme for the retreat. So if people want to come in and join for that, then that's possible. Mark said something about how this life is a form of renunciation because you do need to give up a lot of your preferences and you have, you know, you're following a schedule, and there's also community meetings, and there's like people coming to our monastery, and you have to kind of, sometimes people come to offer a meal, and then you have to kind of be flexible to be able to attend to what's going on, attend to people that come. So there is a, you know, sometimes it's difficult even just to, when am I going to take my shower? Let's see, in between this and that, maybe I can squeeze in my shower, something like that. So it's, if you think about it, I mean, most of you are, you know, if you're working and commuting and all this kind of stuff, you have to really, your time isn't really yours in a certain extent. And so in monastic life, it's like that. But the difference is it is monastic life. And we are, our focus is the Dhamma. And although we have to remind ourselves from time to time to not get off track and get too wound up in work projects and, you know, because there's, especially in this life where there's the internet. I mean, there, well, this is another way that we have to give is that there are people that write us and they tell us that, you know, their son died and then they're asking us to do a service for them and we're counseling them. So we just give ourselves over to the situation. I mean, out of compassion, we have chanting. I almost have some of the funeral chanting, which is very beautiful, actually. It's reflection on death, memorized, because there was a period of time when so many people were calling and writing and saying that someone had passed away that was dear to them. So if it's an opportunity, too, for us to be compassionate and to reflect on death. But, I mean, we have the stories, you know, like death can happen unexpectedly to the people that you least want it to happen to. And so we're hearing people, you know, calling us or writing us or sharing their grief with us and asking for blessings, asking for help. This one lady, she was texting every day because her father, her elderly father, was in the hospital and, you know, it was a number of weeks and then he did end up passing away. But seemed like he was getting better, and it was getting worse, and he was confused. And how do I deal with this? You know, my beloved father is, you know, like, he's distressed, he's confused, he's in the hospital, he doesn't know what's going on. So we have to be able to speak to those people, to be able to be compassionate with us, with them, give our time to them. It's a very dear friend of ours that this was, her father was passing away. And she was a very dedicated practitioner, but this was just so much for her to deal with. And she really was reaching out to us. So this is giving our time to others is one way, you know, it's a form of renunciation. You know, people could be coming, you know, we do have certain hours, but people can, during those hours, people can be coming anytime. And we do need to care for ourselves and have a certain amount of boundaries. But if it's certain situations, you have to give yourself. I mean, you know, you can't turn your back on people. So if somebody's in a crisis, then there's enough of us, fortunately, that, I mean, some are very willing to step up to the bat and really, care for people that are coming. Some are really very available. And for one another, too, the situation. So, if I'm one of our new members is having a health crisis, and actually she had to have heart surgery, and so everybody was, you know, picking up her the work that she was normally doing, and we were, you know, doing what we could to care for her. And a outside community member was taking her to appointments, and so there's a lot of give and take, and it's a lot like a family in a way. But being monastics, we have a certain position in society. So, it's like we say we have a day off, but it's really a day for meditation, for study, for catching up. I mean, we never really have a day off. I mean, I never consider, like, if I'm going on retreat, that's not a break. That's work. I was on retreat last winter. I spent the first month of our retreat at the monastery, and I was managing the retreat, and then it also included that I was giving talks on a regular Tuesday evening. We have a talk, and then Sunday program. So we were keeping that up, and one year we had the seven enlightenment factors. Oh, we were working with the Four Noble Truths. So I was teaching from the first two, because the first month I was teaching from the first two, and then Ayasobhana was doing the last two. So then I went to our hermitage for my retreat time, my secluded time, and I was doing a lot of walking and sitting meditation, even though I was managing. There was still quite a bit of time. But when I was by myself in my cabin, it was like the tsunami of unwholesome states. Just because I was by myself and I wasn't being occupied by anything else but my mind, you know. So it was like, yeah, it's interesting how that happens. It took me a little while for the mind to settle down, but, you know, it's kind of like, aware of unwholesome states, aware of unwholesome states. It's kind of like, and it's like, you know, and you can set them down, but they're still, they somehow still sneak in there. I don't know. Anyway, it took me a while. And fortunately, I allowed myself to look at the suttas too, and that was very helpful. But so going on retreat is not a break. It's a lot of hard work. And and then we go back to the monastery, and then there's a lot going on. So, but it's very rewarding too. And I guess, is that enough? Okay. Is it, it's...
So maybe just one last comment or question.
Okay.
And then we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
Thank you also for being here. Regarding unwholesome states, living together in community, do you have a formal procedure or informal procedures for meeting conflict or falling short of precepts or causing harm to one another, some way to reconcile within the community?
Well, in the monastic form, we regularly ask forgiveness from one another. And we, starting with the senior most, we ask forgiveness, and they also ask forgiveness from us. So this is one thing, just understanding that as human beings, we are going to do things that, not unintentionally, it's really that if anything I did unintentionally through body, speech, and mind, through carelessness, please forgive me. So we do this on a regular basis. Intentionally, if we did something, then that's a little bit more. I mean, we do meet regularly, and we do try to talk through things. If there's a problem on the community level, then we're try to meet about it. If we're breaking precepts, then for the bhikkhunis, we'll confess to each other. We can confess to any other bhikkhuni. And then usually if we're breaking a precept, we try to look at why we did that. Was it like lack of mindfulness? Was I being greedy? A lot of times some precepts we break because during the time of the Buddha, it makes sense, but during this modern time, it doesn't make sense to a lot of people. So there's one precept. We're not supposed to give our alms food to lay people, but we can relinquish it. I could set it down and then say, if you like this, I've relinquished it. But if I hand it directly to that person, then it's breaking a precept. But if somebody is, like we go to alms round in the street, in the city, and then we see somebody in the street and we have excess food and they're hungry, it's kind of rude to set it on the sidewalk or something like that. So this is one of the kind of precepts we might break, and then, oh, I didn't feel right about relinquishing it by setting it down. I felt, you know, really. So we look at, why we've broken the precept. And then if we're confessing the same thing over and over again, then the person might go, oh, well, you better... I'll work on this one. I mean, we don't, depending on the person, but most of us, you know, we, depending on our relationship with that person, too. But it's really a discipline, and we really just need to look at ourselves and hold ourselves accountable. Unwholesome mental states, that's definitely something, you know, we need to be aware of, and try not to bring them out through speech or action. And I think just having other people around, if I'm like, I'm upset and I know one time I was at the Hermitage and I came down and I opened up the door to our yurt, which is our meditation hall. And I was looking for something and I was in a hurry. And I didn't find it there and I was somewhat irritated and I shut the door and the door shut really hard. And I was like, oh, I slammed the door and I felt a little bit remorse. So one thing is you're aware of it. But then this other bhikkhuni later on, a little while later, she said, are you angry? And then I realized why, because she was in the meditation hall and I had slammed the door. And then I wasn't angry then. At the time she asked me that, I said, no. And then I started saying, I think you're talking about because the door slammed. And then I said, well, actually, I was looking for something, I was in a hurry, and I was a little irritated. And then that's why the door slammed. So, I mean, kind of, she brought that awareness, you know, like that she was, you know, like, what's going on? Are you okay? Are you angry? But she wasn't asking me in a way confrontationally, just what's going on? So then, so a lot of self-awareness. And if I notice I'm knocking things over or doing, you know, and I'm disturbing everybody else's working mindfully, quietly, and I'm like, okay, what's going, you know, so this, it's kind of a reminder, what's going on? What, you know, I need to slow down. So just being in the environment, I think, is a support. It helps with being aware of the unwholesome state. So we can kind of help one another in that way.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.